Thanks, Dave. I prefer to use this podium just so I'm closer to the computer. I realize nobody can see me, but that's okay. You know, you're not missing much. Dave asked me to talk a little bit today just about some context around boreal fire in general. So what I've tried to do is set up a presentation that talks a little bit about global fire, talks about boreal fire statistics, why boreal fire is important, some of the characteristics, and some of the increasing vulnerabilities around boreal fire, such as climate change, wildland-urban interface, and things like that. So probably get through this and have time for questions after without any trouble. First off, when you look at fire in a global context, and this is just MODIS fire counts for almost a year in 2003, you can see that there's not a lot of fire activity in the boreal zone compared to some other parts of the world, particularly the tropics, where there's a lot of land use and land use change burning going on. And this has become a major problem around the world. Deforestation at a very rapid rate, and a lot of countries and a lot of people not able to sustain themselves very well without utilizing the forest for things that it wasn't supposed to be utilized for. So it's a prominent disturbance factor in most biomes around the world, and as we all know, in the boreal zone in particular, it's natural, it's essential, and it's an ecologically significant force. But it's also uncommon and unnatural in a lot of ecosystems and biomes around the world. And as a result of fire occurring there now, through land use change in particular, there's a lot of vegetation damage, site degradation, and of course you hear about that in Indonesia, tropical rainforests, the Congo, Brazil, so on. But fire is also a land management tool in many cultures around the world, many societies in the developing world, particularly Africa. So there are increasing vulnerabilities globally with respect to fire. It's a growing population, economic and land use pressures. So we're seeing some really marked changes in fire regimes with very uncertain impacts at local to global scales. Economic, social, and environmental impacts, and the environmental impacts are both terrestrial and atmospheric. And also we're seeing the incidence of extreme wildfire events increasing throughout the world, even in the boreal zone, particularly, as you'll see later, in Russia. We don't know for sure what the scale of global fire is, but we know it's several hundred million hectares of vegetation burns annually. A lot of that is in savannas, so they regrow pretty quickly. But the vast majority of the fires are not monitored or documented in any way. There's been a lot of efforts through the United Nations to try to do that, with some success in some cases, but still a lot of problems. They're using remote sensing and things like that to try to improve the estimation of how much area is being burned each year. But the trouble is that informed policy and decision-making does require timely quantification of fire activity, and so far this information at a global scale is largely unavailable. In the boreal zone, average annual area burn can vary between 5 and 20 million hectares. That's primarily occurring in Canada, Russia, and Alaska. Russia's been a big black hole for a long time in terms of how much fire has actually been taking place over there. You'll see later on there's a great interannual variability in area burn. It can vary by an order of magnitude from year to year. And the main drivers in the boreal zone are the continental climate, extreme fire weather and fire danger conditions, combined with multiple ignitions, usually lightning. Characteristics of boreal fires, I'll get into that in a bit more detail later on, but it's really high fuel consumption levels, fast spread rates, and that combines to give you sustained high intensity levels. So if you can sustain intensity levels throughout the burning period in the afternoon, you end up with these towering convection columns that can reach into the stratosphere directly, and long-range smoke transport issues. Large fires dominate in the boreal zone because of suppression activity. Only 3% of the fires get larger than 200 hectares, but those 3% of the fires account for 97% of the area burned. So the dilemma that fire management agencies have is they're attempting to protect the economic interests in the forest and in communities and things like that, while permitting natural and essential role of fire in ecosystem maintenance. So the way they go about that, the way they worked in Russia, this is just the fire occurrence map for Russia and for Canada for the 1980s, and you can see there's extensive zones in the north of Russia and in Canada where fire is allowed to burn naturally. So they intensively protect the high-value areas, and they modify their suppression efforts in the more remote regions of the country. Because the boreal region is very sensitive to climate change, and we'll talk a bit about that, global carbon budget can be affected. The implications are that it can be directly, fire and insects in particular can contribute directly to global carbon budget, sink source strength and that sort of thing, because 40% of the terrestrial carbon is in the boreal zone. So if you start to tip the balance between terrestrial carbon and atmospheric carbon through increased disturbance in years ahead, it can greatly upset the global carbon budget. So the impacts of what happens in the boreal zone could be global. Some of the recent area burn statistics. In Canada, we have reasonably good fire statistics right back to the 1920s, although it was really only post-1970 when we had satellite coverage of the whole country that we're fairly confident we're catching just about all of the area burned in the country. So the top graph is to show you just how highly episodic the variability in area burned is from year to year. That's the blue bars. And the numbers of fires per year is a solid line, and you can see that that's been increasing, but it's back and forth a little bit. The first statistics that we tried to put together for Alaska, Canada, and Russia, this is this bottom graph here, looking post-1980 for Canada in red, Alaska in yellow, and Russia in blue, you can see that highly episodic nature of area burned in Canada, and you can see it in Alaska. It's a smaller area, but they still do have substantial areas burned in certain years. The thing that's interesting is that Russia seems to be somewhat constant from year to year. Despite having twice the land mass, they don't seem to be showing as much area burned, and we found out later that that's because the Russian fire statistics have been obfuscated for years through the political process. So, in fact, there's no way of knowing exactly how many fires were occurring in Russia and what the area burned was back into the 1980s. And we're working on that problem right now. But since 1995, we've had a satellite receiving station in a number of places in Siberia, and that gives you some idea of how much is actually burning in Russia. More than 20 million hectares in 2003. 2003, and significantly more area being burned there than in Canada and in Alaska combined in most years. So we're getting more reliable statistics for Russia. One of the things that we developed for Canada was a large fire database. The idea there was to work with the agencies around the country and try to get polygons and fire attributes for all the fires post-1950, and some provinces we've got them back. I understand someone was talking earlier about the large fire database. So we got almost 13,000 fires in there up to the year 2000 or 1999. And what you see here is just an indication of the polygons for the 1980s in central Canada, and then over the last 40 years in Canada and Alaska in the middle. And what you see there more than anything is this large band in west central Canada, particularly in the north where large fires are allowed to burn, and in Alaska as well. You can see the influence of that, a lot more area being burned in the far north. And you see that also in the percent annual area burned, some work we did looking at Canada, Alaska, and the continental U.S. as well. This large fire database, there's a paper on it in Journal of Geophysical Research in 2001. What we tried to do there is summarize a percent annual area burned by ecozones, that's in the top left, size classes and different ecozones around the world. Also look at a finer scale, the bottom graph looking at percent annual area burned by ecoregions. And the top one is an attempt to try to separate fires that were actively suppressed from fires that had modified suppression or limited action on them. So the purple in the north are fires that predominantly are being allowed to burn naturally. The role there is usually to let the fires burn and try to protect communities and things like that, or resources as required. wanted to talk a little bit about how we got started working with the Russians. Through the International Boreal Forest Research Association that was formed in 91 with a fire working group. We spent time in Russia in 1992 signing protocols and establishing sort of a research program with the Russians to collaborate on things like fire behavior, satellite, fire detection, a whole bunch of things, fire danger rating. We had a conference there in 1993, and that resulted in the book you see on the top, and also in 1993 we had an experimental fire in north central Siberia along the Yenisei River. They established a satellite downlink in Krasnoyarsk, which is right in the center of Russia, right in central Siberia. And we published a Russian fire modeling book as well. So, and now they're participating in the UFRO Fire Research Group. We had a meeting in Finland in 1995. The UFRO World Congress had a fire program that was heavily devoted to Russia because we could get a lot of Russians to Finland pretty easily. And one of the things that, as I mentioned earlier, we realized early on that Russian fire statistics were not reliable. The government statistics weren't. So by setting up the receiving station, they've gotten a lot better since 1995. But one of the first things that we looked at in 1987, you might recall, this is the Great China Fire. And in 1987, we noticed this fire burning. We knew that it was a million hectares that in size that fire. We could see across the border in Russia many, many more millions of hectares burning. And when we looked at their statistics and they reported about a million hectares, we knew that there was something wrong. So we've done a lot of mapping. That's early GAC data, 4 kilometer resolution. This is the 1 kilometer NOAA. LAC data, which is came into effect in the early 90s, so we're starting to get better information on Russia at that time. One of the follow-ups to the work that we did in the early 90s in Russia was this Fire Bear project, which is right now supported by NASA, but also with a lot of U.S. and Russian and Canadian Forest Service participation. They're doing a series of experimental fires in central Siberia, in this case in Scots Pine, but they're moving over into larch, which is the other main fuel type in that part of the world. And they're trying to develop and validate models for remote sensing-based estimates of area burned and fire severity, trying to develop fire behavior models and for different fuel types over there, looking at carbon cycling, fire emissions, and ecosystem processes and that sort of thing. And at the present time, it looks like probably we're going to be looking at trying to implement, at least on an experimental basis, the Canadian Forest Fire Danger Rating System in parts of Russia over the next couple of years. Our ADM was just over there, and fire is one of the agreements they signed to collaborate on with the Russians. Other experiments, frost fire, this was in Alaska in 1999. It was about 1,000-hectare watershed, and they burned almost, 365 hectares of it. And once again, they were looking at impacts of fire behavior and resulting effect of fire and feedbacks to climate. So there's been some books come out of that. So there's been some good international collaboration to date. The International Crown Fire Modeling Experiment, we carried this out in the Northwest Territories. The burning was between 1997 and 2000. And what was driving that was a number of converging issues. The U.S. and Canadian approaches to fire behavior prediction, their more physical approach and our more empirical approach, were not getting us all the results we wanted. We weren't able to conduct as many fires as we needed to. And their physical modeling beyond a surface fire wasn't working as well. And that combined with the opening of Russia allowed us the opportunity to bring the three countries primarily together to develop a replicated Crown Fire experiment in the Northwest Territories. So you see some of that here. A series of fires over the 1997 to 2000 period. Trying to develop and validate a model of Crown Fire behavior that's more robust, Crown Fire initiation and spread that's more robust. And as always happens, if you build a field, people will come. And so there was a lot of other smoke, a lot of other activity that took place, smoke chemistry, fire shelter evaluation, a lot of interest in that from the U.S. Forest Service. And all of this is published now in a special issue of the Canadian Journal of Forest Research. Boreal fire characteristics. As I mentioned earlier, high fuel consumption, fast spread rates, and if you sustain that over a long period of time, you get convection column dynamics that allow smoke transport directly into the stratosphere, or at least above the tropopause, into the upper troposphere, through the tropopause, and into the stratosphere. Lightning is the dominant cause of large fires in North America. There's a couple of reasons for that. One is that they're often more remote. The second is that they're usually not as quickly detected or as quickly actioned as human-caused fires. But in Canada, on average, although it's highly variable from region to region, and I'm sure other folks will be talking about fire occurrence prediction, but on average, around 35% of the fires in Canada are caused by lightning, but they account for 85% of the area burned. Fuel consumption. The way we try to develop fuel consumption models for Canada and the fire behavior prediction system is that Dave was talking about. We did a lot of experimental burning, starting in the early 1970s right through the International Crown Fire Modeling Experiment in 2000. And you can actually you can measure fuel consumption in a very detailed way, pre-burn and post-burn. Obviously, on wildfires, you don't have a pre-burn sampling capability. But we used a number of techniques to measure crown surface and forest floor fuel consumption with reasonably good accuracy. There's some of the numbers. What burns in a crown fire, generally just the foliage, coniferous foliage and small branchlets in the living crowns, and some fine dead twigs or dead branches in the crown as well. Understory foliage and twigs, ground layer shrubs, some woody debris on the forest floor depending on its moisture content, and the forest floor, the organic layer, to varying depths. Crown fire, or crown and surface fuel consumption seems relatively constant. So once you have a crown fire, those things don't change very much, but the forest floor fuel consumption can change pretty dramatically from fire to fire. So typically, when people ask, we say generally 1 kilogram per meter squared crown fuel consumption, about a half a kilogram per square meter for surface fuels, anywhere between 1 and 3.5 kilograms per square meter for forest floor consumption. So on average, somewhere between 2.5 and 5 kilograms per square meter, which is 25,000 or 25,000 to 50,000 kilograms per hectare. So the potential for greater fuel consumption and intensity depends largely on forest floor consumption. When you combine the rate of spread and fuel consumption with heat of combustion, which is relatively constant for forest fires, to determine fire intensity using Byram's standard intensity calculation, really we use fire intensity as sort of a consummate measure of resistance to control. And we did some work in South Africa in 1992 looking at savanna fires, and if you look at those types of fires, what you see is that they can spread just as quickly as boreal fires, but they're generally burning less than 10% of the fuel. So the result is that their convection columns just are not strong enough to get anywhere near as high as boreal fires. So if you look at this graph on the right, you can see rate of spread on the left and fuel consumption on the bottom. And what you see here is tremendous variability in rate of spread for savanna fires, but very little difference in fuel consumption because it's all grass. And there's, of course, in the boreal case, you can have just as high spread rates, but a lot more fuel consumption. So the overall intensity levels are quite a bit higher. Crown fire development. How does this happen? Generally, a propagating surface fire requires a minimum level of fuel consumption to survive. And when surface fuel consumption reaches a high enough level, fire intensity levels increase enough to start to involve the crown layer. And once they involve the crown layer, then you can access the ambient wind field, because you can understand that when you're burning in the forest, the wind itself is nowhere near as strong on the ground as it is above the trees. So when you access the ambient wind field, you can increase spread rates and intensity quite dramatically. And then the crown and the surface phases of the fire advance in a linked fashion. They're interdependent. There's no separation. Crown fires don't just go in the crowns. They look basically like that top picture from the side from the crown fire modeling experiment. And crown fires do dominate area burned in the North American boreal zone. I mentioned this, I guess, a couple of times, but just to repeat, the high spread rates and fuel consumption, high intensity levels, that if they're sustained throughout the afternoon burning period, which they often are, in the boreal zone, you get a well-defined convection column with the potential for great vertical development. And as I mentioned, you contrast that with savanna fires where the spread rates are similar, but the fuel consumption is much lower. You get a less defined column with little vertical energy. And an interesting thing is if you look at some of the experimental fires that we conducted, these fires were not anywhere near the size of the wildfires you see at the top, but they could still achieve the same intensity level because the fuel consumption and the spread rates were comparable to wildfires under extreme conditions, and that's basically what we were trying to do. But there's no sustained plume development on those because they're only usually a hectare in size, and there's no sustained burning period. So the column, we can think about the column as being an integrator of fuel consumption, rate of spread, and intensity. And the column develops if the rate at which thermal energy is converted to kinetic energy is above the fire is greater than the kinetic energy of the wind field. The reverse of that produces a wind-driven fire. I'm sure you all know that. The height and the dynamics of the column are a function of the atmospheric lapse rate and size and the intensity of the fire. This is only a 50-hectare fire. This is the fire in Russia. But the column from that, because it was a convection-style burn, got as high as 5 kilometers. Columns can attain the full potential if the winds are decreasing or constant above the fire, while higher winds aloft tend to shear off the column. So really, you can think about the column as sort of a solid structure moving across the landscape, and it's blocking the ambient wind, so as the wind goes around it, it's creating mini tornadoes and whirlwinds on the lee side of the column. Within a convection column, there's generally considered to be three different zones. There's the fuel bed, combustion, and turbulent zones, which go up to 100 meters. Then the fire convection zone, which goes up to the base of the capping cumulus, which you can see if you look at the picture at the right. Once the column reaches a certain level, then you move into the condensation part of it, and a lot of the smoke detrains at that point, but a lot of smoke does stay embedded. This is a column in northern Ontario at about 25,000 feet, and you can see there's still a fair amount of smoke with that, so that's part of the reason why smoke can actually get up into the upper troposphere, lower stratosphere. And then the condensation convection zone or capping cumulus rises to the top of the column, and as I mentioned, you can still see smoke there. I wanted to show this because this is one wildfire that we actually did a fair amount of work on in the early days. It was a fire that we actually got to before it really took off. It was north of Red Lake in 1986. This is the column on this fire. I mentioned somewhere in here that it was about 13 kilometers high, and that was confirmed by aircraft, Air Canada planes going by it and that sort of thing. Huge amount of fuel consumption, energy release, and a fire that burned very quickly, high spread rates, spot fires 1 kilometer downwind. It rained in Red Lake, 20 kilometers away, black rain. And this convection column spawned 20 to 25 new lightning fires. And the top picture is actually, and I'll show a few of these later, but that's the smoke from the Red Lake fire up in Ontario on the left. This is the TOMS aerosol index, and they produce this index on a daily basis. So you can go right back to the 1980s and look at any day, at any time, and see what was going on. So obviously there's some fires burning in the lower part of Russia. And what you tend to see an awful lot I mean, this is an aerosol index, so you see either a lot of sea salt, or in the case of the Sahara Desert, you see an awful lot of dust storms and things like that. So every day, when you look at this index, it looks fairly similar in that part of Africa, but it changes quite a bit in North America. So the issue of long-range smoke transport, as I mentioned, the injection height of the smoke depends on the burning conditions, whether it's a column-driven or a wind-driven fire. Most of the savanna fires have the more of the wind-driven approach and don't get very high. If you look at some of these fires, this is 1989 in northern Manitoba. Large number of fires there, and there's a cold front going through, but if you look at it, you can see that some of the columns are about 300 kilometers long, and they do show the lighter spots where the fire is, which means that the column, condensation cap on the column is visible from there. Here's some very highly wind-driven fires in Ontario in 1995. Within a few hours, the smoke was into Quebec. And the one on the right is 2002, very bad fire year in Russia. Just to give you some idea of what some of these columns look like. We've been working with some folks at the Naval Research Lab in Washington, D.C. They got quite interested a number of years ago because within the stratospheric community, no one believed that, no one thought that forest fires could actually loft smoke as high as the stratosphere. They thought that any aerosol they saw in the stratosphere was a result of volcanoes. And then they started to see some in years when there were no volcanoes. And they used the POEM satellite and a couple of other satellites to look through the stratosphere at the sun and look at the aerosols. And this is the 1998 fires in the Northwest Territories. And you can see there's an increased aerosol burden. If you look, this is the latitude. And also that's in terms of time. The tropopause is, I wish I was taller, but the tropopause is there. And you can see the increased levels of aerosol concentration and burden significantly elevated over the polar region and also for many days. So they've been following up with this work now, and they see it on large fires in Australia and in Russia as well. So some of the smoke transport issues, this is the 1995 fire in the Northwest Territories that actually put a large amount of smoke right down into the central U.S. and combined with the urban pollution caused a lot of health concerns. That happened again in 2002 with the Quebec fires when the Eastern Seaboard was affected. There's a lot of concern over smoke transport in terms of combining with urban pollution to create real health risks. We used to think that only occurred in places like Indonesia and that, but in fact we're seeing it occur. To give you some idea of how quickly smoke can spread, this picture in the top right is the 2003 fires in eastern Russia. Smoke is coming off there and already over North America. And this is looking at it with the MODIS satellite. Here's the smoke over Alaska. A day or so later, it's over the St. Lawrence Seaway. And a day or two later, it's over Scandinavia. So it raises a lot of issues about smoke from Canadian fires and Alaskan fires reinforcing smoke from Siberian fires, and what does that mean in terms of climate change implications and things like that. So some of the things we were trying to do in the 1990s, we had traditional areas of boreal fire research, fire behavior, fire ecology, and things like that, but there was an emerging trend towards research on fire as part of larger issues, particularly global change issues and atmospheric chemistry issues. And converging issues were contributing to more international and multidisciplinary cooperation and research. And the reason for that was that funding sources were drying up, research personnel were getting old and fading away, and a lot of the environmental issues that arose in the 1990s were in fact transboundary in nature. There became, at least at the time we started a lot of this stuff in the early 90s, everybody was focusing on the tropics because that's where most of the burning was occurring. And that's where the serious land use change was occurring. But there's been a growing awareness of boreal fire importance globally in recent years, particularly with respect to climate change implications and, as I mentioned earlier, carbon budget implications from a regional to a global scale. We've also, in the 1990s, seen an increase in the ability to be able to communicate easily, to forge scientist-to-scientist collaboration across disciplines, and I think that's really transformed the nature of research in the last decade. We've got new research organizations where researchers could collaborate, International Geosphere Biosphere Program, International Boreal Forest Research Association, they're just a couple of examples of many. Another thing that influenced it was the new funding sources, particularly NASA, which had much broader agendas, and they began to influence our agenda in fire research, because to be write a successful proposal to NASA, you had to be doing more things than just fire and show that it fit into things like carbon or atmospheric chemistry and so on. So that's what brought about a lot of these international and multidisciplinary experiments. If you look to the future, I think there will be a continuation of the core priorities that we've had in the 1990s. We'll be working on development of the next generation of fire currents and behavior prediction models, particularly in the wildland-urban interface, but also in other fuel types. There'll be a lot of work on climate change impacts and adaptation. There's a lot to be done in terms of better quantifying the Russian fire impacts that are national to global scale. And the fire carbon issues, you'll see when we talk about carbon here in Canada, we have a pretty good idea of how disturbance affects the carbon budget of the forest sector here in Canada, but we know a lot less about Russia. As I mentioned earlier, the smoke transport issues, and the urban impacts, and the possibility that fire will become a positive feedback loop with climate change. So some of the increasing vulnerabilities, and this is 2003, in British Columbia brought this home loud and clear. The interface is expanding in both Canada and the U.S. There's an increasing fire severity and the loss of homes and infrastructure. So there's a lot of interest now in community and structure protection. And I think all three levels of government, certainly in Canada, see this as a shared risk. So there's work going on right now to try to develop a Canadian wildland fire strategy that shares the risk between three levels of government, so that the federal government is perhaps more actively involved in fire suppression or sharing the risk up front. So that's an effort underway right now under the Canadian Council of Forest Ministers' direction. Climate change, we started, I guess, back in the late 1980s looking at climate change potential, and as the general circulation models and regional climate models got better and better, we've been rerunning a lot of this stuff, and this is from some of the earlier work looking at Canada, Alaska, and Russia. What we tried to do is compare the actual weather data that we had. We used the Canadian Fire Danger Rating System, compared the actual weather data we had for the 1980s by months with the doubled CO2 using, in this case, the Canadian Climate Model, GCM, or Canadian Climate Center, GCM. So you end up seeing an increase in the strength and the aerial extent of extreme fire danger, particularly in the more continental parts of Canada and Russia, and central Alaska for that matter. You also see an increase in fire season length and increased weather variability and extremes at regional scale. There's been a lot of work going on in recent years in this, and I'll just touch on a couple of things. One of them has been trying to look at area burn projections in the future. And what we try to do is use the Canadian Large Fire Database for the last 50 years and the relationships between fire danger conditions and what's happened in terms of fire activity in Canada over the past 50 years. And use that to project by ecozones out into the future, in this case using a 2x CO2 and a 3x CO2. So 2x CO2 is about 2040, 3x is around 2090. And you can see a substantial increase in area burned by the end of the century according to just about every general circulation model you use. So some of the future research, and some of this is actually already ongoing, try to continue to use the best climate models as they become available. Work with those models to project future fire danger, fire currents, particularly lightning. Mike Watton's been doing a fair amount of work on that recently. And area burn scenarios. And also trying to investigate the major drivers of fire activity to see whether we might be able to forecast fire season activity a little better in a large sense. And two of the keys in that area are tropospheric ridging, which is upper level or mid-tropospheric high pressure systems that, block precipitation from certain parts of the country and can stay in place for long periods of time. We've been doing a lot of work on that with Walter Skinner at the Atmospheric Environment Service, and also sea surface temperatures. Mike Flanagan's been doing a fair amount of work on that with Walter Skinner, and they're seeing some pretty good correlations between Pacific sea surface temperatures and fire activity during the summer in Canada. And also trying to identify ahead of time areas of vulnerability and perhaps concoct or come up with vulnerability or adaptation strategies that policymakers might be able to use to get out in front of the issue a little bit. Talked about carbon a little bit. The Kyoto Protocol, I'm sure you're all aware, reporting requirements put initial climate change emphasis on reducing emissions. This is the 6%, reduce your 1990 emissions by 6% by the first commitment period. And there's been a lot of carbon accounting requirements for this, and the Canadian carbon budget model, Canadian forest sector climate budget model, carbon budget model is has been key to a lot of the work in Canada. But we've also tried to look at what the forest management opportunities might be to increase the strength of the Canadian forests, and we find it's very limited in the boreal because, in fact, from year to year, we vary from a sink to a source depending on how much disturbance we have. And as we say, that's highly variable and episodic from year to year. We have been looking at carbon flux measurements at the stand level, FluxNet and different programs like that using eddy covariance, actually putting instrumentation in the stands to look at carbon flux, and at circumboreal scales as well using atmospheric inversion modeling. And so there's been a fair amount going on in that. Some of the work that Brian Amiro in particular had been doing when he was with the CFS is to look at carbon release through fire. We used our large fire database again going back, you know, into the 1950s. And what you can see here is even though the average is around 27 teragrams of carbon a year, which is about 20% of fossil fuel emissions, that if we do have significant years in Canada where large areas burn, we can actually approach the level of fossil fuel emissions for the country as a whole. And as mentioned also, this is just direct emissions. This is just the combustion phase of the fire. The decomposition or biogenic phase later on in terms of that, that's what the FluxNet measurements are for. Some of the early work has shown that younger forests are a weaker carbon sink than mature forests, then it takes 20 to 30 years to actually be sequestering carbon at the rate you were sequestering carbon before the fire. So you could presume from that that as you see more fire in the landscape and more areas burn in the future, there'll be a change in age class structure, and there'll be less carbon on the landscape. This is taking fire, insects, and logging into account, looking at the Canadian carbon budget. You can see a distinct rise in natural disturbances, fire and insects post 1970. And if you run that through the carbon budget model, you see a corresponding decrease in the carbon sink strength of the Canadian forest post 1970. So right now, the Canadian forest is either a modest sink or a modest source from year to year, depending on how much disturbance takes place. So in terms of climate change impacts, if you have an increase in fire weather conditions conducive to fires, you'll see more frequent and severe fire activity, and some of the projected impacts that seem to make sense anyway, even though we can't quantify a lot of this at this point. More area burn, shorter fire return intervals, some ecosystem boundary and vegetation shifting, probably driven by disturbance. Less terrestrial carbon storage with large impacts on forest industry and communities. Once again, the positive feedback to climate change where you get more fire, you get more greenhouse gases, you get more greenhouse gases, you get warmer, you get more fire. So there's a real need to quantify these impacts in order to assess options. And like I mentioned, to give our policymakers who tend to operate on a four-year life cycle, to give them some idea of what might be coming down the road. I wanted to talk a little bit about Russia again. As I mentioned, more than 20 million hectares in 2003 and 12 million hectares in 2002. And it can vary from year to year. This is the 2003, 20 million hectares, most of it occurring down here in the dry pine forest area to the east of Lake Baikal and right on the China border. This is 2002, a lot of fire occurring up along the Lena River, Yakutsk, that's large forest up there, and very large fires. What they're noticing over there now is they're getting more crown fires where before surface fires were common, and they're starting to see a lot more severe fire activity. An example of that. This is the Trans-Baikal area again. This is the as I showed earlier, the 1987 China fire, and about the 12 million hectares burning in 87 between Lake Baikal and over to the Amur River, and also a number up in along the Lena River. But if you zoom in on that area there in 1987, you see that it's the same area that's burning again just 16 years later. And what that means is that if you look at the top, you can start to see that there's a lot more crown fire activity. That Dagestan development that used to be in the past, it was just kind of perpetuated by surface fire on a regular basis, and that's kind of what it looked like. Now it's starting to look more and more like the pattern you see on crown fires in Canada. So definitely there's something going on in terms of fire severity there. As I mentioned, trying to quantify the extent and impact of fire in Russia is a major challenge, but it's one that is ongoing right now. The post-1995 satellite data is quite good. We're pretty confident we have a good idea of just how much is burning in Russia post-1995. But as I mentioned, we want to extend the baseline back to 1980 so that we have enough of a baseline in Russia, like we have in Canada, to allow us to make climate change projections and look at future area burned. So the big problem there is we know that the records are bogus for that period, so we can't use those. But the indications are, if we start to look at surrogate measures like the TOMS data set, this is 1985, major fires north of Krasnoyarsk in central Siberia. 1987, that's the fire we just looked at, the Great China Fire. And you can see, you can use this index to know where the major fire activity is occurring day by day, right back to 1980. And if you combine that for the whole year and look at longitude on the bottom and year at the top from 1980 to 1990, this is all the aerosol coming off the east side of Siberia, and this is the aerosol coming off North America. So you get some idea that each of the years in the 1980s, even though we don't have fire records for Russia, they had significant fire activity. We also have 20 years of weather data, hourly weather data for Russia, that we're looking at as well. So that's part of this new Canadian initiative, not just our fire danger rating system over there on a trial basis, but also trying to build a baseline for Russia that will allow us to build a boreal data set that we can use to go back a reasonable amount of time in order to make the projections we need for the future. And just some final thoughts here. I think there's a growing awareness, as I mentioned, of the importance of boreal fire globally. And the research emphasis has changed. As I mentioned, boreal fire is part of larger issues. And I think the research has largely adapted. I mean, we haven't had the resources to do as much as we'd like to have done, because the resources are stretched and funding sources are changing. But it's encouraging this recent trend towards more collaboration, not just internationally, but across disciplines. And I think that will and must continue. And it looks like things will change fairly quickly in the boreal zone in the years ahead. So addressing emerging problems requires that scientists share a collective vision and understand that future answers, which we probably need to get to fairly quickly, require extensive cooperation. Thanks. Hi.
You mentioned that all the fire research on lightning fires. Could you tell us a little bit more about that? Think about sponsoring the fire. How that could be used to predict
Well, I was using that more as an example of, like, it's a really high intensity fire, and the column is quite high and the column is quite active, so you're getting all the condensation nuclei and the smoke particles and things like that, so you're getting lightning coming out of there, and it's starting fires further downstream. How often that happens on boreal fires, this is really, on this one, this is one of the few that I've really noticed it on. So most of the, I think, I tend to think of the clustering in terms of lightning fire ignitions as being just like regular weather conditions. But I was trying to make the point here that this was an extreme fire.
Like Andrew Jack, this is the last sort of known example of that dry 18.
Yeah.
It's not a well documented.
No.
Widely observed.
That's right, Dryden 18 and 74, and then this one in 86. Yeah, that's right. Hi, yeah. Well, it's probably both. They have a much larger area. They have a more continental climate over a larger area in Russia. Like, if you look at the climate from year to year, it's pretty consistent. The fire season moves around Russia pretty predictably. But the other part of it is that their system is completely broken right now. So they really don't have the resources to even address much at all in terms of fire. They run out of money quickly, and we're seeing large areas burning now. And they say that that's because back in the 1980s, before the regime collapsed, they had a better capability. But I think the indication is that the fire weather is extreme enough and the area is large enough that even if they were doing a better job then, you're still going to have significant fire activity. I put them all to sleep, Dave.
Okay, thank you very much. Right.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, we are now moving into the deep plumbing. And if you're going to talk about boreal fire, you got to have somebody from an organization called Boreal Ecosystems Research Institute. I'm sorry.
Here, Steve, just a second. Do you want to do it there or here?
I'll do it there. Flaky Linux box, sometimes, right now, its avatar is